Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. I'm your host, Jonathan Gallegos, here with
Jeff Rappaport.
And today we got a special episode for you guys. We brought in Jeff Braleo. Did I say that right?
You did. Right. Well done. Very well done. That's a tough one.
He's a attorney here in Utah. And Jeff, why don't you tell us a little bit about him, why you wanted to get him on the show?
I'm very excited. So Jeff is involved in both real estate investing, title, and he's an attorney. So we get a number of different perspectives from him. He's very much involved with the Salt Lake Real Estate Investment Association. And he's kind of the go-to guy for whenever you have like legal questions about whether it's creative financing or land trusts or just anything in general. So thank you for having you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
So Jeff, tell us, Jeff Braleo, tell us a little bit about yourself. tell us, kind of what you do in real estate. What I would like to know what you're investing in. Personally, and then tell us a little bit about what you do on the creative financing side, because this that's what this podcast is all about.
Okay, first a little bit about my background. I'm an attorney, as Jeff said. I've been an attorney now for close to 20 years plus, graduating in 1996 from Brigham Young University Law School. I didn't really practice law when I first graduated. I went into teaching, which is kind of my truer passion. I just love teaching. So I taught at what is now Utah Valley University. I taught business law and some economics courses there. And because I really like the interaction with people and never really wanted to be a lawyer because it seems so solitary. And that I would sit in an office all day and just crunch papers and not have much of a life. So. Really, I was actually a real estate investor before I even started my law practice.
Oh, okay.
About 1999, I started investing. I bought my first flip. It was down in Utah County. And if anyone's old enough to remember the early 2000s, we had about less than 2% appreciation for 4 or 5 years in a row.
Oh, wow.
So you could not rely on just natural appreciation to help with profit margins. And I remember my very first flip project. I did all the work myself. It took me about 4 or 5 months. After work, nights, evenings, you name it, we'd go out there. And I got my first check, profited 10 grand after, all costs and everything.
Sounds like a lot of work for 10 grand.
It was way too much work for 10 grand. And that's what I learned on my first deal. I'm like, okay, when you took in the time that I put into the property,
oh, yeah,
that my hourly was, I was making more as a teacher than doing the flip project. Even though to cash that $10,000 check is a pretty impressive thing in a young person's life. Like, you've never seen that much cash at one time.
Yeah.
But when you learn about real estate, you realize there are easier ways to do things, which is part of creative financing, which is what we're going to be talking about this morning.
Yep.
So since 1999, I was an investor, mostly flips. I picked up a lot of flips that I actually had to turn into rentals. Again, because I just didn't know the market. I didn't know how to buy. I didn't know how to get it at a discount. I didn't know how to do creative financing. I didn't know how to hire all the things you learn, by years of experience in real estate. I didn't know, and we just couldn't make a profit on a flip. So we turned it into a rental property, held it for a couple of years to at least get something out of it. We got some income flow, which was nice. And then got a profit. So that was my first steps into real estate, and kind of been hooked ever since. In real estate, I sort of met other investors. I realized that they needed legal work. They needed asset protection stuff done, transactional documents done. And so I started just doing legal work for investors here and there, and then slowly I just grew my law practice out of that, and now I'm a full-time lawyer with associates doing pretty much nothing but real estate investment work or legal work for real estate investors.
Nice.
So that's my legal side. Currently, I still will pick up flips. We know the market here in Utah, it's getting really difficult to find good flip projects.
Yeah.
It's a seller's market, bidding wars on everything. Seeing a little bit of 2007 again when investors were jumping in and overpaying for stuff just to get a deal under their belt, which is kind of driving up the lower end market as well.
Yeah.
But still looking at that, I still do a lot of hard money lending, so I'm a private lender.
Okay.
Which, you know, I find I really, really like.
Yeah.
Zero work and really decent returns.
Yeah, exactly.
But I still do flips, and then is when the market turns, which we expect it to at some point, and prices come back down, they'll probably start looking and picking up rentals again. I do have a few rentals, including commercial property, but haven't been doing much in the buy world in the last year or so because of the pricing.
Yeah.
So
that makes sense.
I'd rather safely make money as a hard money lender.
Yeah.
Right now.
So, Jeff, just kind of off topic, but
sure,
I'm
love
curious.
Off topic.
what are your thoughts about the market, both, you know, maybe local and national? Where do you see things happening? What's your theory? What's your thoughts?
You know, I travel a lot on the East. About a year and a half ago, the East Coast was kind of preparing for a downturn. It didn't really happen. It's not as hot as it was on the East Coast as it used to be a few years ago. But the West, which is where we're at, and you know, maybe because I lived through 2007 and 2008, you know, I remember though that, and I said at the time, I mean, I just said this, something is wrong. This can't last.
No.
You know, financing can't stay this cheap. You know, the 100% loans, you know, and the other creative, even 120% loans they were doing in those days.
Yeah.
You know, there's something unstable about this. And then of course it all came crashing down. And so when I see some of those same signs, I still worry, but there's other economic indicators that are really positive, particularly here in Utah.
Yeah.
I think the West, Arizona, Nevada, parts of California, I think are gonna see things like they did the last time a little bit harder than Utah. Utah's very insulated in its economy.
Yeah.
We generally lag behind our population. it's just, we have a strong influx of people. Interestingly, people think it's driven by Californians. Coming in, selling their houses, you know, at top dollar in California and buying inexpensive here. But actually, the population growth here in Utah is birth rates.
Yeah.
Much more than migration. And we just have very large families, and those families get older, and then they have more large families, and it's exponential. And there's and the family-centric nature of Utah keeps people here. You know, normally kids grow up and they leave the nest, but here they stay, and they stay close to family. So I think that's a positive sign. I certainly think we're probably good for a good 6-12 months. But right now, there's nothing that I would do with a long-term forecast. I wouldn't want to take my crystal ball farther than 6-12 months out right now.
It is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, I think, at least for me, I've thought something's going to happen for the last like year and a half.
Yeah, I know,
and
me too.
It's like, well, when's it going to happen?
I wake up every morning.
Yeah.
Turn on the news. Did it happen?
Yeah, right. It's like we've been waiting. There are a lot of signs that are saying something will happen, and then there's some internal signs that are like, is it really going to be that bad? So,
talk to retail agents. They're really starting to struggle now.
Yeah.
Because their buyers are being priced out.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rose Park, for example, is now over 320.
Wow.
Yeah. So if you're a local, you know, no one ever thought that Rose Park would ever break 300, and it flew past it.
Wow. Which is certainly one of the things that I'm worried about, at least locally. And, you know, we work in two other markets, and it's certainly Idaho as well, where I'm starting to see prices are getting so high that the affordability is just not there anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And people have jobs, they can qualify. but in, you know, particularly Utah and in this part of the West, wages are still pretty low.
Yeah. They're certainly not keeping up.
They're certainly not keeping up. Yeah, they're starting to rise a little bit, but they're not keeping up with the pace of housing.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting. Well, I wanted to.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to ask every guest that we have on
question.
Here. Yeah, I'm just curious. Yeah, I'd love to hear what people's perspective is.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah. All right, so let's dive into some creative financing stuff. So we have a couple of different perspectives here. One is you do some creative financing yourself as an investor, and two, you get to see all the other creative financing that other investors are doing. So give me an idea of a little bit of both. What are you seeing? What do you like? What do you, you know?
Okay. What I see obviously most of are sort of your traditional seller financing deals. I always break that into three kinds of seller financing, where one is a seller owns the property outright, the dream situation, right? And they just become a bank.
Okay.
There's a situation of what I call a subject to, which is really just taking over the mortgage payments. The seller's got to get out of their house. You just want to help them out by taking over the mortgage payments.
Okay.
Then there's a wrap, where you buy a house, there is an underlying mortgage, but the seller is getting some kind of monthly payment over time.
Okay.
So those are the true kind of seller financings. Then you've got contracts for deed, and you've got lease options. And those are probably the standard bearers. Utah, I don't think we utilize lease options.
We don't.
Yeah. It's just never really caught on, and I don't know why. I think it's a great option, but you just don't see it a lot. And we can talk about those, and I know a number of your questions are geared toward those are what we kind of consider the core seller financing. But what I also see, it's also creative, that a lot of people don't think about, is partnering with others. Anytime I talk about seller financing, to me it is a partnering deal.
So are you talking partnering buyer with seller partner?
Yes, one is partner with seller. We do actually are probably, I've got clients that are doing about one a month now of partnering with the seller. Okay. So what they do is they're going and they're negotiating with the sellers, and they're finding maybe the margins aren't good enough for a wholesale. Maybe it's not good enough to just do a traditional flip, to buy it, rehab it, sell it. But the house could use some work.
Yeah.
You could force some appreciation quite easily. And the sellers, you know, aren't real comfortable about selling at a rock bottom price. And the sellers themselves, and you get this all the time. They're like, oh, no, well, my neighbor just sold their house for blah, blah, blah. And you're sitting there as a house going, you are not going to sell this house for that. And so, you know, but if you did this, this, and this, you might. And instead of making $5,000 now, and if you could force, let's say, $20,000 in equity to sell, and then you split that, the seller's now gone from $5,000 to $10,000.
Right.
And you're making $10,000.
Right.
And so these are situations where almost sort of little joint ventures, agreements, and we secure rights with notes or notices of interest so that the investor who's put in the money is protected. But the seller actually keeps the house, stays in the house. There's no sales transaction at this point.
Okay.
And they kind of partner through the rehab project and then sell it and then split profits in some fashion on the end. So that's okay. One thing that we see quite a bit.
That's certainly different.
Yeah,
that's creative. That's something we have not talked about on this show, really.
Oh, good.
About partnering.
Yeah.
So thank you for bringing that up.
And you can partner with contractors and hard money lenders.
Sure.
Contractors can easily provide essentially free labor in exchange for a profit on the back end.
Is there such thing as free labor?
No, but instead of paying a contractor now, it's shelling out a lot of cash, which you need to finance probably with hard money at 12%.
Right.
You partner with the contractor who's essentially bringing you creative money. It's his labor that you're not paying for at this point, and you're just deferring that cost until the profit on the back end.
Yep.
Like that.
So there's that and hard money lenders. I very often partner, especially if I'm hard money loaning and it's a newer investor, I usually partner. I don't just loan.
Yeah.
And you can do that through something called a shared appreciation note. So I loan the money, but I have a share of the equity instead of an interest.
So my question is, if you're doing a joint venture such as that with like a new investor as a hard money lender, are you getting involved in the project? Are you like making sure they know what they're doing?
To varying degrees.
Yeah.
Yes, but I will almost certainly check in. I will oversee budgets. I'll look at the numbers. I may help with contractors. I will swing by the house. Usually, it's a hard, if it's just very hard, I've got clients that I just, I'll loan all day long to. And I never even talk to them until they pay me back.
You got regulars.
Yes. But on the others, yeah, I will, I'll swing, I'll usually go by beforehand, look at their project schedule and what they're planning on doing and what repairs and remodels they're trying to do and help out to a degree.
Well, and you know, doing a rehab, and we're doing one right now, and we've overspent. I mean, there's just no two ways around it.
I overspent on mine, but mine's at least my personal residence.
Yeah, well, you can justify that. I can't.
No.
So, but as a new investor, you never quite know when is good enough.
Right.
And at the same time, you have to do good enough, or you're not going to sell it. Right.
Yeah. So, and that's a good point. And I kind of was thinking about this on the drive over. Is we always try to like compartmentalize things, especially when we're teaching. You know, to classify things and teach this one thing. The one thing I'd like to say is, you know, every deal is different. And when you're in this game long enough, you know that every deal is going to be different. You know, when I hear young investors like, oh yeah, I've done two seller financing deals, and then they try and jump into these super creative like double wraps and double financings, and it's like, holy cow, you have not seen enough of the world.
Sure.
to really understand the risk of what you're doing.
Yep.
Because you could do 1,000 seller financing deals, and you're going to come across one that just blows your mind, and you're going to learn on.
Yep.
And you kind of have to expect that there's going to be something different about every deal you get into.
Absolutely.
The seller, the house, the type of financing, the way you do it. So experience. Experience matters.
Absolutely. So what's one of the most creative deals you've seen put together?
That's a pretty general question.
Yeah. It's partying with the seller, but I'll tell you the numbers involved. Okay. And I was the lender, and I was a consultant on the project as well. And the investor knew the owners of the property. They just happened to be some friends. And it was on the east side of Salt Lake City. And the house was one of those square bungalows. And there was a $180,000 mortgage on it. And in its current value, it's probably worth $250,000 to $300,000.
As is?
As is.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. But homes in the neighborhood are selling for $450,000.
Okay.
And so they wanted to flip it. So what they did is, the investor partnered with the seller. The sellers kept ownership. They kept the mortgage in place. So there was no financing of the purchase. And I was probably at a 5% interest rate, so that was easy. The sellers actually agreed to continue making those payments, so the investor, again, didn't have to put up anything for that. Nice. I loaned the rehab money.
Were you a partner on this too?
Or was a consultant on this one. So my hard money lending, I got paid just my interest rate, but then I got paid as a consultant. And I was working with the investor, and we both struggled. And the reason I bring this up is the pitfall of partnering with sellers or partnering with anybody. And in creative financing and working with sellers, the seller was a commercial general contractor.
Oh wow!
I know it's what's going through your mind because you're experienced enough to know he's wanting to do things at a certain level. He wants extra thick cables and wiring and he wanted to overimprove it.
Yep.
And that's why when you're talking about overimproving, I was thinking about this, and we kind of butted heads a lot. And at the end of the day, we kind of conceded a little bit, and they went over budget probably about $10,000, which I think we easily could have saved. That I probably could have saved another $15,000. But the downside you're gonna get, again, of partnering with sellers is you now have a partner.
Yeah.
And they're gonna have their own opinions and things that they want to do, and sometimes they're stubborn.
Yeah.
And so. But at the end of the day, the investor made, I think, around $60,000 or $65,000.
Do you have an idea what the seller got out of that deal?
About $80,000.
So he, and this is just me thinking out loud. Mm-hmm. So, and I don't. This wasn't really your deal. You were just a part of it.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to understand. So if the seller owes $180,000 and they end up getting, let's say, $60,000-$80,000 out of it, I'd rather just give them their equity, be into it for what, $250,000, $260,000,
right,
and have the deal for
yourself.
Yeah,
yeah,
much simpler for me.
Very simple, but what if you went to the seller and the seller wasn't willing to do that?
Well, then I guess it really depends on, because obviously the more the spread is that, so what if the seller thinks, all right, well, I'm going to get $100,000 out of doing this split, but hey, goes over budget, holding costs are more than what we expect. We don't get the price that we wanted when we sell it. I get $75,000 now. So now you have a disgruntled seller and partner that, you know, I would absolutely, if you're going to use this kind of technique, find someone just like you, an attorney, that can write this up, because there are a lot of moving parts and things go bad. I mean, it happens
project,
all the time.
Every project goes bad. Yeah.
So speaking of that, tell us how you're able to secure the investor on that. Because if there's no title transfer, the seller has that security. They still hold title, right? So there's obviously a joint venture agreement in place.
There's a joint venture agreement in place.
Is there anything else filed on title for the investor?
Yes, a notice of interest is filed on title referencing the joint venture agreement.
Gotcha.
And in that joint venture, one of your questions was like, what clauses you joined in?
Yeah.
Anytime you go into either a joint venture agreement, a purchase contract, seller financing contract for deed, et cetera, make sure that in that document, it clearly says that the seller, the owner of the property, grants an interest in land and it authorizes the buyer or the other party to record a notice of interest.
Yep.
The reason being, that's not required under the law. And I've taken a number of cases to court, because every investor now, it's almost standard to put a notice of interest on a property. You know, they go under contract, they're worried the sellers are going to bail or another investor is going to come in and offer more, which happens all the time.
Yep.
And so, they got the contract and then they'll record the notice of interest. And the very first thing the opposing counsels are going to argue is that the contract, a purchase contract, doesn't create an interest in land. Now, we're in real estate, that's just stupid. I mean, obviously, it's a right to buy the house. It is an interest. And there's good case law that is an interest that substantiates the notice of interest placing it. But without the specific language in whatever document you're using,
the seller grants interest.
An interest in land and authorizes the buyer to place a notice of interest. Then you show the opposing counsel, look, here's my paragraph, you lose.
Yeah.
Right? Without that, even though you probably win anyways, and the judge is probably going to say, yeah, you know, a purchase contract, that's a vested right in the land to buy it. You know, so you win. But so the key comes in avoiding that at all. From the beginning, you know, just avoiding the even possibility of having to deal with a judge, and because I tell you, you get into
you've already lost.
I mean, it's time and money, and you never know what a judge is going to say. Even you could have the most solid case in the world.
I've had one.
I know. Yeah,
it
I've
only
seen
took
him too.
5 years for me to resolve.
You know, and I walk out and go, "What was that judge thinking?" You know, but so the goal is to avoid that at the outset.
Yeah,
as opposed to winning. You know, everyone says, you know, I just want to be able to, you know, fight win. I'm like, you don't want to win in court. You never want to go in the first place.
That's right.
Yeah.
So. And the tighter those agreements are, and I mean, I'm always thinking, what can go wrong? And because not that I'm a pessimist or anything, but I want to cover,
you're a realist.
Hey, if this is what happens, yep, this is the remedy, rather than we're going to fight about it now and try to figure out who's right and who's wrong.
Yeah.
So what if in that scenario, the seller doesn't want to sell after the home's fixed up? They don't sign a...
That case just came to me.
Hey, lovely,
like
thanks
2 weeks
for picking
ago
up my house. I'm going to stay.
Another client, and the seller's like, well, I just got this new rehabbed house. I got new paint and carpet. You know, I don't want to move out. A way to protect yourself from that is a note and deed as opposed to a notice of interest.
Okay.
A notice of interest is a cloud on title. It will prevent the seller from selling the house without coming to you and clearing that and making sure you get paid. So it does protect you in the sense that if it's ever sold, you have to get a payoff. You know, the title company can't clear title unless you get your money. But a notice of interest doesn't come with the right of foreclosure.
Right.
So it doesn't give you the ability to actually take the house back. A trust deed here in Utah, or a mortgage in mortgage states, comes with the ability, the ability to foreclose.
Right.
Which means if the seller doesn't honor their agreement, you can go through the process and foreclose and take the property back.
Okay. Okay, so is that something that you recommend your clients file on title?
Yes. Yeah, and I was talking with my associate, Cody, yesterday, because he had a question about some financing. And he's like, yeah, well, my guy wants to loan money, but doesn't really know how much. It might be kind of like a construction loan. It might go up, whatever. And he's like, do I have to put a number down? I'm like, no, you don't need to put a number down on the note or the deed. In fact, on most of my lenders, we put in undisclosed on the actual trustee. That way, people don't know how much you bought the house for.
Right.
Yeah. Yep. You know, but you can write the note and deed with any terms you want. It could be a work term. If someone doesn't provide certain services, they're in breach of that note. You know, so there's a lot of ways to write in your documents terms that if are breached, then you can foreclose on the house.
I like it. I love it.
That's interesting.
That's pretty creative.
Yeah.
I like that.
Yep. So you had mentioned basically, like, I think it's pretty close to the 4 or 5 different methods that we've talked about since we started this podcast. Mm-hmm. So subject to.
Yep. Yep.
Lease options.
Yep.
Trust deed and note.
Yep.
All-inclusive trust deed and note.
Yep.
And contract for deed.
Yep.
And then I think we have one more, which we talk about subordination sometimes.
Oh.
So. Okay. But let's talk about a couple of things because... And I know this just about you. You're not a fan of contract for deed.
That's correct. Yeah.
And
yeah.
So you'd much rather title transfer.
I would much rather title transfer.
Trust
yes.
deed and note, subject to, all inclusive.
Right.
Can you give me an idea? But what is it that you don't like? And why do you like it? You know, in terms of title transferring.
Yeah. There's. I teach an hour class on this.
I know you do. And you don't need to go into.
Yeah.
And I've heard it actually.
Yeah. I know you have. There's, I think the, in a, when there's an actual transfer of title and a sale, and the seller becomes a lender, those laws, particularly in states that don't do a lot of contracts for deeds, and there are states that that's sort of their primary method of,
yeah.
of transferring title,
yeah.
To the Midwest.
Yeah.
We don't do that here, so we really don't use them. Lawyers aren't familiar with them. Courts aren't familiar with them. We don't really have any law specific to them. So it's really just a contract, based on contract law. And so when there's a transfer of title and you become a lender, we know what your rights and risks are as an owner of a property. And we know what your rights and risks are as a lender. And we've got very strong lender laws and very strong even landlord-tenant laws. If you're the owner, you got to rent it out. And so the laws are very clear, and I can predict the outcome much more easily if something goes wrong because we have long-standing experience with these kinds of transactions. The contract for deed is you're sort of in the middle there. Okay. It's not a true sale because title hasn't transferred, but there is an equitable interest that does transfer. So the buyer does own the property in a sense and owns the equity. The seller holds title. There are some courts that will view the seller as a lender. Other courts will view him as an owner. But so you're kind of stuck in this gray area in the middle, which then has to be argued in court. And anytime you get into court and you're arguing like what things are supposed to mean, what the terms of the contract are supposed to mean, then you run the risk of, again, that judge who you just don't know how he's or she's going to rule.
Sure.
And so the outcomes are less predictable. And when I see from the litigation side, you know, problems that come in, I see infinitely more problems that arise from contracts for deeds than from notes and deeds.
Okay.
Gotcha.
What about one of the things that comes up quite a bit is you find a seller that has an underlying mortgage and mm-hmm. you want to wrap it. So you want to create a new note that's going to encompass that underlying note.
Correct.
And then, you know, whatever difference is going to the seller. Now, FHA, VA, mm-hmm. been kind of a bit of a problem. Do you see people wrapping FHA or VA loans, underlying VA, FHA loans?
All the time. I close them all the time.
Okay. And you do them as, like, all-inclusive trustee?
As to an all-inclusive trustee,
okay.
Yeah.
So you don't have an issue with...
I've never seen it.
Okay.
20 years now, I've never...
And I know it's kind of ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, something came out like 20 years ago and...
It was in 1997, actually,
yeah.
The letter. I've seen it. I don't think I have a copy of it anymore, but I did. I had a copy of it that... One, FHA and government entities don't send out letters like
Do you want to really quickly just explain what letter we're talking about?
Yeah, there's a letter that was circulated, at least here in Utah, that I can't remember if it was from FHA.
I think it was FHA.
Yeah, that came out that basically said that, and it was to title companies, by the way, not to investors.
Right.
It was to title companies that said, if you wrap an FHA loan, we will blackball your title company from closing originated FHA loans.
Right.
I just don't buy it. I don't think that letter was true. I think it was a fake letter.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I really do. The FHA just wouldn't say that. They wouldn't come out with a letter saying, we're going to blackball you. And that's the word it used.
Yeah.
And that's just not what a government agency does.
Yeah.
Does wrapping an FHA loan, like any other conventional loan, cause a breach of the due on sale clause? Yeah, absolutely it does. Yeah. Every mortgage has the due on sale clause, and in every you're in breach of it.
Yeah.
You could
argue that a lease option actually...
Yeah, if a lease option isn't done correctly, it does violate the due, absolutely.
Yep.
Reading that letter just never sat well with me. I just didn't buy it. And the fact that no one has ever seen it actually happen in 20 years, I just don't... Yeah, to me, that's a non-issue. That's not an issue. The due on sale clause, however, I think is somewhat, if you're going to do seller financing, any kind of creative deal where a mortgage is staying in place, you just need to understand the due on sale clause, the risks, and have an exit strategy.
But so let's talk about that because this comes up every single time that you do any kind of creative financing is how do you do with the due on sale that, you know, and in my opinion, you should be telling the seller that there is a due on sale clause on the loan.
And your document should actually include that they understand their mortgage is staying in place.
Yep. Why don't we talk a little bit about what it is, which we've done several times.
Okay.
But what are the risks? How do you deal with it?
Yeah, the risks are simply the seller of the property will get a notice from the bank that says, we understand that your property is sold, you have 30 days to pay it off. I've personally seen that only a couple of times.
Yeah.
Both were local, one was a local credit union and the other was Utah Housing Authority.
Which is notorious.
For checking title.
And they will try to call every loan.
Who the payment check comes from. And
they will call every loan due. Yeah. So they are the exception, not the rule.
They are the exception, not the rule. I've never seen one from like a Bank of America or Chase. And so what happens, I've even talked to people who have seen these. And at that point, there's two risks. One, that letter is going to go to the sellers. So you have to remember, if you're in a seller financing deal, that's why I teach, when I teach seller finance, I teach as a partnering class. You are partnered with that seller. You're in a relationship with that seller for the life of that, whether it's a note and deed, whether it's a contract for deed, whether it's a lease option. You're in bed with that seller for the entire length of that contract. And anything that happens to either party is going to affect that contract. So in a seller financing situation, and the due on sale clause is called in, the seller, because they're the borrower on the mortgage. So they're going to get the notice. And if you're not in touch with your sellers, you don't communicate with them, most likely they're not going to communicate back with you. They may throw the letter away and you may never know. So continual communication with your sellers is key. You just can't walk away from the sellers in these kind of deals. Second is you can negotiate with the bank. When we close seller financing deals, we make sure, especially if it's on a wrap, that the buyer also gets a lender's letter and a specific power of attorney, so that if that letter does come in, then the investor has the legal authority to call the bank, talk on behalf of that borrower, and negotiate something and say, look, hey, we got that, we've been making the payments, which usually most investors do, I find.
Yeah.
And say
it's a moot point if you're not making payment, right?
I mean, if you're not making payment,
you're in default.
And remind me that after this session, because we have a case that just like that follows that. And so you can negotiate with the bank, say, look, you know, give us time to sell it. We'll just sell the house on the open market. You'll pay it off that way. You could refinance it if you really in a pinch. You know, if you've got hard money lenders in your pocket, which you should. Like, so if you can do a lot of seller financing, you have to have access to money.
Sure.
You can get a hard money loan and refinance it that maybe buy you some time or just negotiate more time with the bank. I've had clients, and they've told me this. This is anecdotal evidence because I didn't see all their paper, but they said they got a call from the bank. They called the bank back. They had power of attorney and said, you know, look, can you give us more time? You know, we're willing to negotiate or, you know, help out or sell. We'll work with you. Bank never called him back.
Yeah.
6 months, 9 months, bank just never got it back.
Yep.
And I think that's probably pretty standard, especially the bigger banks. Again, the Utah Housing Authority, rare outlier.
I'll tell you really quick about the Utah Housing Authority. There was a foreclosure going on. They're always in second position because of their down payment, right?
Right, down payment assistance.
And there was a foreclosure going on, and it was like a few days away, and we called them to come in and make the reinstatement, and the seller had already called them and said, I'm thinking about transferring this property, and they literally told us, we may not even accept your money to reinstate the loan. So we said, well, never mind then.
Yeah,
but that's the last thing you want is that is you don't want a bank. I almost don't care that the bank knows. I'm not going to go out of my way to tell them.
Yeah, yeah.
But I almost don't care because most of them just don't care at all.
Most of them don't. No, you are
so,
correct. We teach it usually in the guise of just reduce the red flags.
Yeah.
You know, do all you can to reduce the red flags. And
so let's talk about that.
Okay. Yeah.
How do you reduce the red flags? What are the red flags, first of all?
The red flag, the biggest red flags are communications with the bank. So don't you ever, I've had clients say, oh yeah, well, you know, they gave me the authority to talk to the bank and I wanted to talk because they were in arrears. They wanted to bring them current, then buy subject to or something like that.
Yep.
And I said, oh, why did you talk to the bank? Like, oh, well, my sellers didn't really know what to say. I'm like, no. Okay. So the big one is communication with the bank.
Sure.
And don't communicate with them at all if you don't have to. Don't use your power of attorney or the lender's letter to communicate. Again, this is a partnership with your sellers. Have them call the bank. You can do it right there with them. You know, you can guide them through it, tell them what to say. But have them call and ask questions and do things and, you know, get the payoff to bring it current and stuff like that. Because if the bank finds out that you're thinking about selling, they'll more likely, you know, maybe red flag it and keep an eye on it and see what happens to it. We recommend going online access for payments. If it's a bigger bank, they almost all have them, and you can usually change the bank account. If you're worried, another kind of protection for the sellers and make them feel comfortable, is you can go set up a bank account, a joint bank account with you and your seller's name. And so on the seller's name's on the account. So when you set up that account as the auto draft or something for the bank, you're going to type in the seller's name, not somebody else's name. And then you put money in like the day before, and then it comes out the next day. Or you do it online, just do two clicks of the button, transfer money in, pay the mortgage. Your seller's not going to steal it.
No.
You avoid escrow specialists. And the bank never knows that the money's not coming from the actual borrower. Make sure you do get the documents in advance, like a power of attorney, lender's letter, insurance letter. Get your own insurance. That's the big one.
Yep.
People are like, oh, it's going to cost me an extra $800 a year. I'm like, pay the $800 a year.
Right.
That is cheap insurance.
Yep.
Because when you change, if you just change insurance, the insurance company is going to notify the bank. And so the bank's going to get a notice. The one insurance has been canceled. There's a new insurance with a new named insured, which is you. Okay, and they're going to go, wait a minute, why? Now, Bank of America, it's probably being processed by some underling in the bowels of some building, and it's never going to go. But you don't know.
Right.
And so leave that mortgage.
They will figure out, if you didn't name them, the bank, as the mortgagee, they'll figure that out.
And make sure insurances are paid, because the bank will come in and get their own insurance, and then they will look at title. Just go and get your own insurance policy. You're the named insured, and you don't report that to the bank.
Do you name the seller as anything in that insurance policy?
No, not in the second one.
Nothing.
No,
so
they've got one already if need be. So I suppose you could, but when we do insurance, it's always name you as an individual and your entity that you're doing it in.
Okay.
Okay. A lot of people will do it in their entity because that's what, you know, everyone buys their properties or flips properties in their entities. But name yourself as an individual as an additional insured.
Okay.
Being that there are ways to pierce the corporate veil, there's ways to get through entities, and there may be liability attributed to you, if you, especially if you did work on the property, that may attach to you and not your entity.
Okay.
So.
So basically, communication with the bank.
Communication with the bank.
Which is, now, and by the way, you should have a conversation with the seller. Like,
absolutely.
Do not go tell the bank that you've sold the house.
Yeah. I mean, that's mistake 101 by newbie investors, is they're not having the right conversations with sellers.
Yeah.
You know, they're not talking about the due on sale clause. They're not talking about bankruptcies. Because we just had this come through our office, is someone bought a house, seller financing 12 months ago, everything's going great. The sellers now filed for bankruptcy.
Yep.
Which brings up a whole other set of issues.
Yep.
And the buyers, the investors, you need to have that conversation. Because remember, if you're getting a good deal, something's wrong with the house, something's wrong with the sellers, or both.
Yep.
And if there's something wrong with the sellers, they're high risk for filing for bankruptcy, which could really ruin your life. And so if you talk to them and, you know, what other debts do you have? You know, because you're helping them. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
You're helping them getting out of a bad situation.
Yep.
But if they start going, I've got this credit card debt, I've got medical bills and blah, 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 and workforce service judgments, which we see all the time. You should be thinking, okay, this guy's on the edge of filing for bankruptcy, and be very careful about the deal. If there's good numbers, take the risk.
Yeah.
You know, but I wouldn't take a high risk for low numbers.
Are you more concerned about the bankruptcy in that it could look like, hey, the bankruptcy court now is like scrutinizing that deal that there may
be? Oh, they
been.
Absolutely will.
Yeah.
They absolutely will. If there's, the nice thing, and one of the things I don't like contracts for deeds is if title is transferred, the presumption of the bankruptcy court is that the buyer owns the house and it's no longer an asset of the debtor.
Yeah.
It's the debt still attaches to the debtor. And depending on what kind of bankruptcy they do, so, you know, 7 or 13.
Yep.
It could just kind of just fly by. And the court, the trust, not the court, it's the trustee and bankruptcy.
Well, 13, they probably don't care, right?
It's only
the 7 that you're worried about.
The risk with the 13 is it's the bank's going to get notice of the bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And if the seller, the debtor, the borrower here, has to provide a list of assets and liabilities.
Sure.
And that house is no longer listed as an asset.
Yep.
If the bank takes a hard look at that document, they might find the due on sale clause. I mean, nothing's, you know, you sell the house, it's just a due on sale clause problem at that point. But
in the worst case scenario, the bank should be kind of happy that, hey, here's our guy that's filing bankruptcy and we got someone else making our payments.
Yeah, and we've been and our payments have made for the last year. So we're better off. Yeah. Yeah. And so and banks, I think, kind of get that.
Sort of.
you know, but if, like, for example, in a contract for deed, that's still listed as an asset of the borrower, which then the trustee has control over, and you just lost control of your house. And so, but have the important part is have those conversations.
Yeah.
So conversations, can you briefly touch on the documents you were talking about? You said a lender statement.
We get usually a lender's letter, an insurance, which is essentially, every bank is different. And you could search this in advance. Every bank is different on what they require for somebody else to talk to them about a mortgage. Some lenders, you can do it over the phone. Like you say, hi, I'm the borrower on this mortgage, but here's my friend, and I'm giving you authorization, and then just hand the phone. Okay? Some banks want just a letter that's signed by the borrower. Some banks want their own specific form filled out and signed by the borrower, and some banks actually want a power of attorney.
Yep.
So we usually do a lender's letter and a power of attorney because that covers most situations.
Okay.
And in advance.
So before, that just allows you to talk to the bank.
That allows you to talk to the bank.
On the behalf
which
of
is
the seller.
A gigantic pain because if you're sending in an authorization to be able to speak to them, that I swear every bank, it takes a week to get into their system, then they've never gotten it. And you got to start all. It could take several weeks to even have your name in the system.
Here's what they do on sale clause. It's going to do the same thing they do on sale clause. Their processing is just terrible.
You're right.
So the power of attorney and lender's letter. We do an insurance letter, which is an authorization for the investor to speak to the seller's insurance company in the event we still recommend the buyer get his own so that you almost never even have to deal with the seller's insurance.
Yeah.
But at least you've got a letter in advance to do that.
Yeah.
We usually will go through, make sure they've got online access, you know, and passwords and codes and bank accounts and those sort of things. But the big ones are the lender's letter, the insurance letter, and the power of attorney.
Right. Cool. Well, thank you for that.
And so as far as the due on sale, so we've covered kind of the red flags, covered how we would deal with them. What, in your experience, when I think we were in the middle of, so a bank called the loan due and the seller was negotiating, you know, some of the options that you have. Mm-hmm. But let's say that you just bought this property like a year ago, and maybe there wasn't a tremendous amount of equity, and some reason the bank calls the loan due. By the way, I've done creative financing for 15, 16 years now, and I've had one loan called due.
Yeah.
The seller told them.
Yeah, there's always a reason.
Was it a Utah?
They worked with me, and they let me, they wanted me to qualify for the loan, but they did not check any of my assets, my bank statements, nothing. They just put together some papers and I signed it. It basically allowed me to assume it with no qualifying.
How long ago was that?
2005, four, so
even pre-crash.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, pre-crash. But so I've never had much of an issue. Yeah. I see it, and I'm going to ask you in just one second. One situation that I wonder what will happen. But
okay.
Did we cover everything as far as, you know, here are the red flags?
I think so.
Okay. So my only concern ever with taking over, you know, whether it's subject to, whether it's all inclusive, whether it's contract for deed, doesn't really matter, is if interest rates go up, like kind of where we're going now, but let's say they get to 6-7%, and we've got a bunch of loans out there at 3.5, 3.75. That is typically the only time that I'm ever concerned that a bank may call a loan due. What are your thoughts on it?
That is definitely a riskier situation. And I've also, to be blunt, I've been hearing that for 18 years.
Yeah.
And you know, for 16 of those 18 years, interest rates only went down. But they did hit rock bottom, and they are kind of creeping back up.
Yep.
And I think that is a consideration to take into account and to understand that banks could start taking a harder look at seller financing if they think that there's a large number of low interest rate loans that have been seller financed that they can make more money on.
So
are like 25 million or something mortgages in the U.S.
Yeah.
I just don't see banks sitting somebody down and saying, "Hey, Joe, will you start looking up title on 25 million properties to see if anything's changed, just so we might make a few extra percentage points on."
Well, but
you are correct in the assumption that that is an incentive for banks.
Well, and the way I look at it is, all right, if Bank of America is my underlying loan at 3.5%, and they say, well, hey, interest rates are 7%, we should be getting twice as much.
Right.
And they call the loan due, what are the chances that I'm actually going to go refinance back with Bank of America?
Right.
I'm going to go get a loan. So they're going to lose the loan rather than get the 3.5% or whatever.
So
I see it both ways, but that's really the only... it's never bothered me at all. And
you know, you get on the chat boards like, you know, BiggerPockets, which are great forums, but you always get, you know, everyone, the paranoia kind of, everyone likes to be paranoid in anonymity.
Yeah.
And, but you talk to experienced investors. I mean, the people that own hundreds of properties and most of them seller financing.
Yeah.
They're like, I've never worried about it in my life.
Yeah.
You know, and if it calls due, well, you know, I'll sell it. You know,
I'll figure it out.
Yeah. You know, I'm in a place where I've got options. You know, I have access to money, or I can sell real quickly, or, you know, there are ways, there are extra strategies.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think that this is the part that's kind of always bothered me. It is totally legal to do owner financing, right?
Yep.
I mean, there's nothing wrong with it, whether it's all-inclusive trust deed, whether it's trust deed note, whatever. It's always, legal.
It's legal.
Yet, the bank is saying, that, so we have a loan, it's legal to wrap a loan, right?
Yes.
I mean, totally legal.
Mm-hmm.
Yet there's a rule that says, all right, it might be legal, but we don't like it, so we might screw it all up for you, right? It's like it doesn't even make any sense.
Yeah.
But it happens every day, all over the country, in mm-hmm. every market.
In every market. And, you know, some of the naysayers are like, you know, it's fraud. It's not. Yeah. Now, I can easily see, this is one of my issues with investors I really try and teach, because this is my industry, especially here in Utah, obviously.
Sure.
Not just I'm a lawyer providing services for investors, but this is my industry. This is how I make my living. I don't want a lot of government interference. I don't want bad things happening. I don't want people telling me what I can invest in, how to finance, or things like that. When investors are new investors and gung-ho investors are jumping into things without knowing what exactly they're doing, they are pushing the limits of fraud, especially with seller financing. We're kind of going to get into wholesaling. I know you wanted some
yep.
questions and updates on that.
Yep.
That is a big deal to government entities and is the fraud thing. But back to the due on sell clause, you know, it could rise to the level of fraud if you start communicating, if the bank does find out or you do things to sort of hide it from the bank. So the seller financing part isn't the illegal part, but the deception
sure.
to keep it hidden could be.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. be aware of that if there's contact and from the bank and whatnot, just be honest.
Yeah.
You know, just be honest, because at that point you don't want to get into like.
You mean as far as the bank contacts you and says, "Hey, are you the owner of this property?"
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. That, you yeah. should probably just say yes, I am.
And people, the use of trusts.
Yeah.
You know, and changing mental filters. There, that was a whole other hour
sure.
on top of using trust or LLCs, what we call disposable LLCs,
yep.
which kind of helps with who really owns the property
right.
kind of thing.
Which is still a good method.
It's still a good method. Yeah. Yes. It is one more step to kind of reduce a red flag.
Yes. And
but when push comes to shove, because I'm a lawyer, be honest.
Yeah, if the bank contacts you and asks you if you own the property,
and you really do.
Yeah, the best case is to say yes.
Yes.
Not say no. Now you have lied and you have created some fraud. So.
Yeah. Or miscommunicating or lying to your sellers about what a due on sale clause is and the mortgage stay in place. Because if they find out later, they're going to be upset and they'll call the bank.
Yeah. No, and they should absolutely be signing something as
acknowledgement that there is a, yeah.
Yeah. We understand that there's a due on sale, that it could be called due.
Yeah. And in most seller financing, I do recommend a specific seller financing contract as opposed to a standard basic purchase contract and then trying to do an addendum with certain language in it. There's a lot of things you want in a seller financing deal.
All right, guys, we're going to stop it right there and make this a two-part episode. Thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your guys' attention. Please pass this on, share it if you're loving the content. We absolutely want to get this out to everyone that we can who's in the real estate realm. So if you guys want to reach us, you can reach us at www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. Again, www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. Please rate and review our show on wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play. We need that feedback to continue to bring you guys the best content in creative financing. So until next time, create some terms.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.